she rang me half an hour later. "You wait until you hear this one," she said, laughing. James had answered the call and was already on his way to A&E. The patient was perfectly well. He was 81, not 67, and they'd completely misinterpreted the brain scan, which was normal. Bloody targets. By the time that I had got home, it had started to rain. I changed into my running clothes and reluctantly headed for the small suburban park behind my home. Exercise is supposed to postpone Alzheimer's. After a few laps round the park, my mobile phone went off. "Bloody hell," I said, dropping the wet and slippery phone as I tried to pull it out of my tracksuit and answer the call. "James here. I can't stop the oozing," a voice said from the muddy ground. "What's the problem?" I asked, once I'd managed to pick the phone up. "I've taken the clot out and put a drain in, but the cavity is oozing a lot." "Well, not to worry. Line it up with Surgicel, pack it, and take a break. Go and have a cup of tea. Tea is the best hemostatic agent. I'll look by in 30 minutes or so." So I finished my run, had a shower, and made the short journey back to the hospital, but in my car because of the rain. It was dark by now with a strong wind, and there had been heavy snowfalls in the north, even though it was already April. I parked my car in the scruffy delivery bay by the hospital basement. Although I am not supposed to park there, it does not seem to matter at night, and it means that I can get up to the theatres more quickly than from one of the official car parks, which are further away. I put my head past the doors of the theatre. James was standing at the end of the operating table, holding the patient's head in his hands as he wound a bandage around it. The front of his gown was smeared with blood, and there was a large pool of dark red blood at his feet. The operation was clearly finished. "All well?" I asked. "Yes, it's fine," he replied, "but it took quite a while." "Did you go and have a cup of tea to help stop the bleeding?" "Well, no, not tea," he said, pointing to a plastic bottle of Coca-Cola on one of the worktops behind him. "Well, no wonder the hemostasis took so long," I said with mock disapproval, and all the team laughed, happy that the case was over and that they could now go home. I went briefly to check on the tumour patient, who was now on the ITU for the night as a matter of routine. The ITU had had a busy week, and there were 10 patients in the large and brightly lit warehouse of a room, all but one of them unconscious, lying on their backs and attached to a forest of machinery with flashing lights and digital readouts the colour of rubies and emeralds. Each patient has their own nurse, and in the middle of the room there is a large desk with computer monitors and many members of staff talking on the phone or working on the computers or snatching a plastic cup of tea in between carrying out the constant tasks that are needed in intensive care. The one patient who was not unconscious was my brain tumour case, who was sitting upright in bed, still looking red-faced but wide awake. "How are you feeling?" I asked. "Fine," he replied with a tired smile. "Well done," I replied, as I think patients need to be congratulated for their surviving just as much as the surgeons should be congratulated for doing their job well. "It's a bit of a war zone here, I'm afraid," I said to him, gesticulating to the depersonalized forms of the other patients and all the technology and busy staff around us. Few, if any, of these patients would survive or emerge unscathed from whatever it was that had damaged their brains. "I'm afraid you won't get much sleep tonight." He nodded in reply, and I went downstairs to the basement in a contented frame of mind. I found my car with a large notice stuck to the windscreen. "You have been clamped," the notice said. And there was a long list beneath this, accusing me of negligence and disrespect, and so on and so forth, and telling me to report to the security office to pay a large fine. "I really can't take this any more," I burst out in rage and despair, shouting at the concrete pillars around me, but when I furiously marched round my car, to my surprise, I found that none of the wheels had been clamped, and then, when I came round to the notice again, I noticed that added in ballpoint to the notice were the words, "Next time," with two large exclamation marks. I drove home, torn between impotent rage and gratitude. Chapter 4. Melodrama. Noun. A sensational dramatic piece, with crude appeals to the emotions and usually a happy ending. I was recently asked to talk to the scriptwriting team for the TV medical drama Holby City. I took the train from Wimbledon to Boreham Wood at the opposite end of London and went to the well-appointed country house hotel where they were meeting. There were at least 20 people sitting round a long table. They were thinking of adding a neurosurgical ward, they told me, to the fictional Holby City General Hospital and wanted me to talk to them about neurosurgery. I talked for almost an hour without stopping, something I don't find very difficult to do, but I probably concentrated too much on the grim and tragic aspects of my work. Well, surely you have some more positive stories to tell, which our viewers would like, somebody asked. And then I suddenly remembered Melanie. Well, I said, many years ago, I did once operate on a young mother who was just about to have a baby and was going blind. There were three patients for surgery on that Wednesday, two women with brain tumours, and a young man with a disc prolapse in his lumbar spine. The first patient was Melanie, a 28-year-old woman in the 37th week of pregnancy who had started to go blind over the preceding 3 weeks. She had been referred as an emergency to my neurosurgical department from the antenatal clinic of her local hospital on Tuesday afternoon. A brain scan had shown a tumour. I was on call for emergencies that day, so she was admitted under my care. Her husband had driven her to my hospital from the antenatal clinic. When I first saw them on the Tuesday afternoon, he was guiding Melanie down the hospital corridor towards the ward with one hand on her shoulder and the other hand holding a suitcase. She had her right arm stretched out in front of her for fear of bumping into things, and her left hand was pressed onto the unborn child inside her, as though she was frightened she might lose it just as she was losing her eyesight. I showed them the way to the ward entrance and said that I would come back later to discuss what should be done. The brain scan had shown a meningioma, a supracellar meningioma growing from the meninges, the membrane that encases the brain and spinal cord, at the base of her brain. It was pressing upwards onto the optic nerves where they run back from the eyes to enter the brain. These particular tumours are always benign and usually grow quite slowly, but some of them have estrogen receptors, and very occasionally the tumours can expand rapidly during pregnancy when estrogen levels rise. This was clearly what was happening in Melanie's case. The tumour did not pose a risk to the unborn child, but if it was not removed quickly, Melanie would go completely blind. It could happen within a matter of days. An operation to remove a tumour like hers is relatively straightforward, but if the visual loss before surgery is severe, it is by no means certain it will restore vision, and there is some risk it will make it worse. I have once left one person completely blind with a similar operation. Admittedly, he was already almost blind before the operation, but then so was Melanie. When I went to the ward an hour or so later, I found Melanie sitting up in her bed, with a nurse beside her completing the admission paperwork. Her husband, looking desperate, was on a chair next to the bed. I sat down on the end of the bed and introduced myself. I asked her how it had all started. 3 weeks ago, I scraped the side of the car on the garage gates when I was coming home from my antenatal class, she said. I couldn't understand how I'd managed to do it, but a few days later I realized that I couldn't see properly out of my left eye. As she spoke, her eyes moved restlessly with the slightly unfocused look that people have when they're going blind. It's been getting worse and worse since then, she added. I need to examine your vision a bit, I said. I asked if she could see my face. Yes, she replied, but it's all blurry. I held up my hand in front of her face with the fingers outstretched. I asked her how many fingers she could see. I don't really know, Melanie said with a note of desperation. I can't see. I had